Hello and welcome to Father Figures, a show about parenting with an emphasis on fatherhood, on common fathers, fathers of all stripes. Here is where we explore the joys and griefs, the risks and rewards of being a parent. I'm Stephen Amaya. This episode is a bit different. My guest today is a mom I met recently in Astoria who has raised a family with another mom. Also, this guest today has asked to remain anonymous. There are pros and cons to this, but after due consideration, I opted in favor of her request. What I seek here on this show is for guests to feel comfortable in conversation, and thereby more forthcoming, and so more relatable to you, perhaps. Well, that's my aim, anyway. So let's get started, shall we? First of all, I want you to know that I am not versed in the trans culture or the queer culture. I mean, which would you prefer to give me an arc of your life, or an arc of your parenthood?
Okay. Let's see. I'm one of those struggling human beings who've gone along doing the best they can, doing things that they could do.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much my arc.
Okay.
I started out as a child and as a young adult in heavily involved in different kinds of activism. And then I went and got involved in education and career and then family and all that. And I've only fairly recently, in the past, five or so years, really landed with both feet back in activism. So.
Oh, great, great! And is this activism what community is this activism in, basically?
Started out in the civil rights and then peace movement.
Oh, excellent!
And since then, the stuff that happened just around the turn of the century and working toward all the protests that happened in downtown Seattle and things like that. They were interesting and Black Lives Matter and all that. I've always been vocal in what I believe, but I haven't necessarily put myself out there.
Yeah. Now, putting yourself out there is a very courageous thing.
My mother always used to say that there was a line that we were challenged to cross every single day.
Yeah.
And behind that line, it was safe and comfortable and easy. And across that line was helping other people, speaking truth to power, fighting oppression, working for justice, and putting yourself in harm's way.
Yeah.
And really, it's hard to do that at first.
Yes.
But the more you do it, the easier it gets. And really, the only things that will give your life meaning and absolute value are happening across that line. So it's up to you.
Yeah, it sounds like you had some pretty good parents.
I think so.
Yeah.
Of course, my father died when I was three, so I learned about him mostly by rumor.
Oh, okay.
But he was involved. He was the executive director of the ACLU in Chicago in the early 50s. Had to leave that position because of threats. And the board of the ACLU found him a job in Austria, so the family went off to Austria.
Oh, wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah. The ACLU is a great group.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes they take missteps, like supporting Citizens United, but most of the time they have their feet in the right box.
Yeah. What risks do you encounter that typical parents don't?
Well, back in the early days when we were parents, it was very much of a stealth activity. I mean, people weren't ready for two mothers. It was not something that people were willing to or were able to really process and accept.
Yeah.
I mean, when the school would call and Lynn would be at work and I would go in and, I thought we were calling Sam's mother.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. well, she's at work right now. So I had to come in her place, and I could,
Just let me get a gist of what your situation is. There are these children, and I'm assuming they are not your biological children. Is that true?
One of them is, the other three are not. But
Oh, okay.
we adopted each other's children back before you could get married.
Yeah.
Because
Okay.
you had to do that, because if one of them had to go to the hospital, you had to have standing.
Yes.
And so you had to adopt the child.
Yeah.
They're all my children.
How many kids?
Four total.
Four.
Okay. The eldest is now 40.
The oldest is 40. Wow, mine just turned 34. Yeah.
I've got one of those too.
My dad's.
We have four. We had four boys, and Lynn always said that she hoped that at least one of them would turn out gay, so that we'd have a son-in-law to come over and do chores.
What's been the deepest disappointment you've encountered as a parent?
In being a parent? Well, I guess I would wish that my own children were more into activism than they have been. I think that is that I don't force anybody to do anything. I'm not going to tell them what to do. They're adults. They get to make their own choices and live their own lives. And it's not for me to tell them what to do. But I feel a little disappointment that I haven't seen more activism in them. Now, they were all out for Kings too.
Yeah.
That was nice. But I don't have any problems with them. I mean, none of them turned out to be terribly wrong politically or racists or any of these other things that they could have turned out, you know.
Yeah.
Of course, I also washed a lot of dishes, mopped a lot of floors and stuff.
Yes. What problems do you think will emerge in the future, you know?
Well, all this regressive stuff that's going on now is really harmful to people.
Yes.
And it's harmful to everybody, not just the people that these repressive measures land on. I feel very sorry for the trans people. I've known a couple of people in this area who moved overseas because they had trans children, and they were being bullied, and they couldn't get any traction out of anybody to do anything about it. And one family moved to France, and the other one moved to Norway.
Yeah.
And that's just around here.
Yeah.
And they were lucky that they were able, in a position where they were able to do that.
Yeah, not everybody is. Yeah.
Not everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, if they started deciding that, you know, like in the olden days, that lesbians deserve to be in mental hospitals, I'd probably go to a mental hospital rather than leave my children behind. One has to remember that when they liberated all those concentration camps in Europe, and they let all the Jews and the communists and the labor leaders and the gypsies and all those people go, the people with the pink triangles on, they put in other prisons.
Yeah.
They didn't liberate them.
Pretty sad.
And those are some of the good old days they want to go back to. And I think that's a very bad mistake.
Yeah.
I know quite a few people, Navy people, and they're just mad because, you know, they say that anytime you limit the pool of available people that you're going to draw talent from, and you say, okay, no, you can only be this, and you can only be this, and only this, and everybody else is not under consideration, you'll get less talented, less capable people. You won't get the best.
Yeah.
You'll get some good people for sure, but you won't. You won't get as many of the good people because you turn down this, you know, huge pool of people, and you only accepted this little tiny sliver. And that little tiny sliver is going to give you the same mix of people you would have gotten from the big thing, but you got the higher end from the big pool.
Yeah.
And, you know, just on the basis of the logical fallacy of doing that, it's just terrible. And it will result in a less quality of people in the military.
Yeah.
And, you know, just inevitably by pure statistics, not prejudices.
Now, were you in the military?
No.
No.
I worked with military people in former occupations, but I was never in the military myself.
Okay.
Although, if you go to Google and you Google my name and do the AI thing, it says I was in the military, in the Navy, but it's wrong.
Oh, okay.
Good old AI. It makes stuff up.
Oh, man.
I'm so glad that I got to retire, you know, this far ahead. of having to use AI in what I did for a living.
Oh, because man.
It's a bad mistake. Don't do that.
Yeah.
There are some things AI can do spectacularly well, and I'm in favor of those.
Mm-hmm.
It works. It works better. It works faster. It works cheaper. Go ahead and do it. You bet. But a lot of the other stuff, it's not a one-size-fits-all, one solution.
No, it's not.
It's just crap for many things.
Yeah.
And my son, Michael, who is an artist, he said that if he had had AI around when he was 13 or 14, he's 35 now, he would never become an artist, because the way you become an artist is you do something and you don't do it right, and you don't do it right, you do it a little better,
yeah,
and gradually sneak up on getting better and until you can do it right.
Yeah.
But if you can just press a few buttons and get something that's better than you can do it,
yeah,
why would you go through the process?
Yes.
It's counterintuitive. Same with musicians. Why would you spend all the time and effort practicing and doing all the scales and all the other stuff you have to do to teach your mind and your body to use this instrument as a virtuoso of that instrument?
Yeah.
Why would you do that? You can just make it happen with a machine.
Yeah.
I mean, you can teach an AI thing to paint Rembrandts.
Yeah.
But they're not Rembrandts. They're absolutely correct. They would have fooled an art critic in 1900.
Yeah. Yeah.
But they're still not real. They're not. They don't have the soul.
Yeah.
There's a lot of different ways of viewing the world. I've always found great sympathy with Lao Tzu.
Oh man, yeah. The Tao teaching, the edition that came out in the 70s. It was a paperback, but it was really well done. Lao Tzu,
I've got one I'll share with you. It's one that I took and adapted and degenderized, and about 1975 I did that.
Wow.
And so it's a very interesting document. Thing, you know, I remember things like people starve when taxes eat their grain. And the faults of starving people are the faults of their rulers.
Yeah. Yeah.
The other one about how a person of true fitness spawns a village, which spawns a region, which spawns a country, which spawns a world of fitness. How do I know this is true? Because it could all begin with me.
What did you have to learn about motherhood being where you are today? I mean, what's been your biggest lesson?
Well, I think that in our case, it was a collaborative and cooperative affair.
Yeah.
It was something that we did together, something that we both felt was important to us and did it in our own way.
Mm-hmm.
And it happened, it was we were both in it in together. And I think a lot of couples have differences about that. The women are very much on their own compared to how we were, because we were right there with one another. And there's a feeling when you get after you've had a child that is, then used to call it the, you get to feel suddenly much more a part of eternity.
Mm-hmm.
That everything is, there is this cosmic connection between you and everything else that was before and will be. And that, you've now participated in this. And, she said it's about the holiest experience you can have.
Yeah. Yes. Yes. When my daughter was born, it just changed everything. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. A lot of the jokes you thought were funny before, they're not funny anymore. And I guess I'm still too much of a parent, because I don't get the Jackass movies and videos and things.
No,
I don't
neither.
Get them. I look at those and I think, oh God, that would hurt. Oh no, I don't want to watch this.
Yeah.
It's like the worst parts of everybody's day they can imagine, and they happen over and over, and people think it's funny.
Yeah.
And I don't get that. I was a special little critter in the forest.
Yes.
This individual atom of creation. And there were other critters in the forest. I wasn't a complete narcissist, but I was very, I felt separate and distinct and different.
Ever since you were born.
I mean, what I remember
Yeah.
from that far back, but
Right.
as I grew older and older and older, I got to feeling more and more different than I'm at this end of my life. I'm feeling more like one of the trees of the forest.
Ah, yes. Speaking of trees in the forest, what was your father like?
He died when I was three, so I have very few memories of him specifically. Well, I think the only one I really have a clear memory of him was him chasing me around the yard, and he was going to spank me. I deserved it, but I was running away anyway. And that's pretty much my. He took me to his office in the Empire State Building once.
Oh.
I remember the smell of leather and cigars.
Oh, yeah.
But, you know, not much else of actually him. And of course, some of the memories I have, my older sisters say, well, you know, he didn't actually do that. He just wrote the check. But he was a very, very good carpenter. He always liked working in wood. And all the time I was growing up, we had pieces of furniture that he'd made, bookshelves and little tables and things like that, that stayed with the family forever.
How has your parenting style changed over the years?
Well, it's hard not to be in charge. I've always striven toward a parenting style, much like my preferred style of management, which is get the best people you can, train them the best way you can, take any obstacles out of their way, then get out of their way.
Yeah.
And we always encouraged our children to amuse themselves and to find their own amusements and to do things themselves and et cetera. And they would do them sometimes one-on-one, sometimes in a group. I mean, one time, one of the dogs we had dug a big hole in the yard. Well, they made it even bigger. And of course, that was now their fort.
Let's see. What's the greatest risk you've taken with a child?
Well, Joseph was a very angry person his whole life. And I don't know, there was one time when he almost threw me down the stairs. Because he was bigger than I was, and he was stronger than I was. And, you know, he didn't actually do it, but it could have worked out that way.
Yeah.
But, you know, because I was telling him something he didn't want to hear.
What was it? What didn't he want to hear?
I have absolutely no idea. I don't remember in any way at all.
Yeah.
But then, you know, he's had a hard time in the last few years because he fell in love with a young woman who had a child already, and he loved the child too, and it was very close to both of them. And he was hopeful that that would develop and he could make a family with them. And then she killed herself.
Oh, man.
And that really tore him up because, you know, he felt like people always do, you know, I should have known, I should have prevented, I should have, you know, should have, could have, would have.
Survivor and, guilt.
And it's really hard. And you can't intrude in that grief. You can't.
No.
You also can't make it go away. And that's really hard.
Yeah, you can't go around it.
But we've been very lucky. We didn't have any children with birth defects. We didn't have any real learning disabilities or anything like that.
That's great.
I guess the closest we had was Michael because he has this really strict artistic temperament. And he has always wanted to do something until he could do it right. And didn't want anybody to know he was doing it until he could do it right.
When he was very small,
he wouldn't talk and he wouldn't talk and he wouldn't talk. He'd say one word and then nothing. And we were just on the verge of getting him seen to, you know, should we take him to somebody and a voice coach or somebody, you know, whatever you take a kid like that to. When he walked up behind Lynn one day while she was at the refrigerator and said, "May I have a glass of orange juice, please?" Now we could talk.
I guess they.
And we told the kindergarten teacher with him that Don't push him into a corner because you won't win.
Yeah.
In the second day of kindergarten, he was, they were doing art projects and he was drawing something and it was time to do something else. And he wasn't ready to do something else. He wouldn't do something else. And she tried all the stuff in her catalog of stuff you can do. And she ends up saying, I'll have to call your mother. Okay. But he wanted it anyway. He didn't want to be here with this person bragging on him.
Yeah.
Go home, finish his drawing.
Now, how many kids are involved in your life? How many?
Now?
Yeah.
I have very little contact with children around here.
Okay.
Mostly old folks like me or like us.
Okay.
And my eldest son has a woman that he's been living with for 15 years, but they can't get married because she's a type 1 diabetic, and if they got married, she'd lose her health because they have to pay millions of dollars for insulin.
Yeah.
So they've never gotten married, but they're essentially married. They're married, really.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of like we were. For different reasons.
Yes. But,
and, you know, all four of my children live together, and she lives with them.
Okay.
And there's a certain amount of friction there and so forth, but... You know, oh, that's right. Ed and she won't have children for the same reason as, you know, Steel Magnolias. And none of my other children have, other than Joseph, who thought he was trying to have a family, have really gotten with other people and had a relationship that might end up in children. So who knows? I might not have grandchildren. Like a lot of people these days say, well, you know, why would I bring a child into this dumpster fire?
It's a beautiful dumpster fire.
Well,
yeah, bringing kids, you know, you and I were talking earlier about how there's when you have younger ones below you, you feel like it's going to go on. It's going to be okay, you know, especially if you have, you know, some say in educating them and directing their lives and that kind of thing.
We felt that way very much. I know I felt that I couldn't really bear it if there wasn't something to carry on with some of Lynn after Lynn was gone. And that's really one of the reasons why I was able to carry on after she died, was because I'd made her a promise.
Mm-hmm.
I said I would be there for our children when she was not there anymore. And I had to keep that promise.
That's good.
So dying was not an option.
Yeah.
It was attractive, but it wasn't an option.
Tell me about Lynn.
Well, let's see. We met in boarding school in Yorkshire, in England. When she turned 16, she got a full scholarship to university. But it came with a catch that her stepfather would have to pay £25 a month toward her maintenance. And he wouldn't do it because she was a girl.
Hmm. Wow.
So she got an apprenticeship as a hairdresser that he arranged for, and she became a hairdresser. So that's why my hair looks like this, because she did my hair for 45 years. And only once did I go to a salon and have my hair done.
Yeah.
And I got back home, and she was mad. I was in trouble, because she said it would take her three times as long to fix what those idiots did to my hair. Don't ever do that again. And I said, okay, I won't. So I don't. I have clippers. Yeah. I cut my hair off and I'm fine.
That's what I do too.
She couldn't cut my hair anymore because she had cancer and was dying. I cut my hair that the first time. And she said, wow, if you're going to look like that and you're a lesbian, you better be a good cook. I guess that's where Michael gets it from, because she always did the things she was good at. And what she did, she was really good at.
Yeah.
Very, very smart, very applied. But if she had a fault, it would probably be her temper, because she really did have a big temper. But she used anger a lot to power through things when she was too tired or too this. She would get angry and then she'd do it. And she'd get it all done and then she'd collapse. At school, I remember one of my friends there said, why do you take all from Lynn? Why do you let her treat you like that? Well, you know, no, why do you take this? I said, well, if I don't take it from her, she's going to be stuck with it, isn't she?
Oh, expression. Yeah.
I guess we matched on that frame because, you know, our school names were Pike and Dyke. And I was the Pike because I was the cold fish. And I was very volatile. And I just sit there and, you know, okay, well, what do we do now?
What part of the world was this where you had Pike?
Oh, Yorkshire.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. When did you leave the Isles?
Oh, I went after I left school. I went to university there because I got to go.
Yeah.
They wouldn't. I was perfectly happy to pay that money for Lynn to go to college, but she could. I had to be a relative. I wasn't a relative, of course.
Yeah.
So, but as soon as she turned 18, I hooked her out of that household because her stepfather also always wanted to have sex with her when her mother was out. Not an ideal home life.
Yes, mothers. But
college was an interesting experience. I was in the second year of women who were in that college.
Wow.
The college was founded in 1586. Hmm. And the first three women students were allowed in 1974.
Wow.
And boy, did they have stories.
Oh, man.
every single one of them was taking the place of a more qualified male candidate, of course.
Yes.
And had doors slammed in their faces and people spit on them from balconies. And the first year, the women's restroom was out the front of the college, two blocks down in a public convenience. And it is kind of interesting looking the way I am and sounding the way I do that I'm quite often assumed to be a man, and I don't mind that. If you want to give me your male privilege, that's fine.
Uh-huh.
But then when people begin to wonder whether I am or not, or decide I'm not, and treat you differently, that's the bad part.
Yeah.
Lots of different ways you can order your life. And I grew up with an abiding fear of being normal. I was always expected to be exceptional. That was the only possible alternative, was for me to be exceptional.
Yeah.
I mean, my sisters were all exceptional in their ways. My sister Janie was a National Merit Scholar and all that kind of stuff. And she actually got thrown out of a women's prison in Connecticut. Because when she was involved in a draft board action, and everybody that was in that group with her got a year in prison.
Wow.
And they didn't want to send all the women in the group to the same federal women's prison in Alderson, West Virginia. So they sent her to this prison in Connecticut. And the first thing that happens to you when you get to a state prison is they give you a whole bunch of tests. Well, she wasn't doing anything else, so she took those tests. Uh-huh. And they were on the phone to the feds that afternoon. She's smarter than anybody in the state. We don't want her. She's your problem. Get her out of here.
Wow.
And we were very happy that that happened because it turned out that that was the state women's prison that had the highest pregnancy rate of any prison in the country.
All right. Well, I think we're done.
Okay.
All right. I want to thank you for being a guest on the show.
Okay. Bye.
I want to thank Jason Shaw of Audionautics.com for the music, and CC Blanca for production assistance. And of course, thanks again to our anonymous mom for her gracious candor in the conversation. If you'd like to get in touch with me, and I wish you would, please send along an email to RadioRanchero@gmail.com. Thanks for listening, and remember, the days may be long, but the years are short. Till next time.